right, so I'm going to crank up. And maybe I won't go so fast so I get through in a hurry like I do sometimes. I got a lot to do. I zip through it too fast. But hope nobody had too much trouble parking tonight. I've got one lot out of commission out there. New paving going on. We'll be in Matthew 24 tonight. We'll do the review first, and then we'll look at Matthew 24. We're sitting in the last week. We're down. It's a long day on Tuesday. We're still Tuesday night, best we can tell. Very long day of cleansing the temple and then all the teaching he did and the woes from the Pharisees and things we'll see in the review here in a minute. And then what happens in Matthew 24 tonight still fits in this, what we think is Tuesday. Well, Jesus has now come to the point in his life where he came to do, what he came to do. That is, save his people from their sins, to seek and save the lost, and to give his life a ransom for many. And that's coming up in almost a matter of hours now. We talked Sunday morning about the Sadducees a little bit. It's the elitist group that wanted to bring some of the Greek culture into the Jewish way of life, opposed to the Pharisees and their way of thinking along these lines. Also opposed to the Pharisees as far as the way they looked at the law. The Pharisees were bringing all the traditions, the oral law, the things that had been handed down from generation to generation, and all the hedges that they put around the law. The Sadducees, on the other hand, would look at the written law, the Torah, the first five books, the books of Moses, where they got their stuff. No angels, no afterlife, no spirits, nothing after the resurrection, did not believe in the resurrection. Again, totally opposite to the Pharisees. So, still on Tuesday, and they come to try to trap Jesus. So they ask him this question about this woman who was married to a man and died without having any children. And the law says that the brothers to marry her and raise up children to the dead brother's name. So, second husband died with no children. They go through seven husbands in their little trap they're putting here. Then they say, which will be her husband in the resurrection? And they actually use the words resurrection, which they don't believe in. So Jesus just tells them then, says, are you not mistaken? You don't know the scriptures. He goes on to tell them that after this life and the resurrection, when the dead rise, there will be a resurrection. He's telling them first, there's neither marriage or given in marriage, but they're like the angels, where there's no marriage. And I guess it was Sunday night in Steve's lesson, but he was talking about how you approach someone and how tolerant you are to them when they disagree with what you might believe. I thought about this passage, Mark and Luke both recorded a little bit different as a statement here. But notice here on this one, Jesus spoke and answered them, put in the form of a question. Are you not therefore mistaken? I just thought about this easier way to say something to somebody if you disagree with them instead of saying, you're just all wrong about this. Just put in the form of a question. Aren't you mistaken about this? He goes on and talks to them. So anyhow, that's kind of ran across my mind. It's the way Jesus approached his answer to them here. And then when he got nothing out of there, with the Sadducee described asking, he says, which are the greatest commandments? Which he just goes back to Deuteronomy and to Leviticus, and he says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. And the second one's like, to it, love your neighbor as yourself. And the scribe says, you're right. And the scribe was one who would know the law. That's what he did. He copied the law, a lawyer at times. So he could get on the trap in there. So Jesus turned it back on him now and says, okay, let me ask you a question. Whose son is the Christ? Which Christ is the son of? He asked him this question. But the answer was, he's the son of David. Which is, of course, right. But what Jesus asked him then was, okay, if he is the son of David, of course, David was the first king in this dynasty through which Christ would come. If he's the son of David, why does David call him Lord? The king would not normally call a son Lord. That's what he says in Psalms 110. The Lord said to my Lord. Jehovah said to Christ, sit down at my right hand. So why is David writing a psalm called him Lord? course, the whole point is that Christ was living then. The I am. He always is, always was. So David spoke of him as his Lord, which he was there. And they couldn't answer without it too. Peter used the same reference here on the day of Pentecost when he's trying to get them to understand who it is they killed. They killed the Christ. They killed the Son of David, Messiah they were looking for. So Peter goes back and references the same psalm here at that time. See, they couldn't answer. They didn't know how to answer how he would call him Lord at that time. So they ask him no more questions. That just kind of stumped them. That was it. So then we go into chapter 23 and all the woes he puts on the Pharisees and the talking about the Pharisees. And it says, you know, they want to be called Rabbi, which is, you know, my great one, my great teacher. And this special recognition, if you will. And they make the long prayers and they want you to call them by special names. And he said, don't do that. You got one teacher and the rest of your brothers. And he said, they'll be called Father. There's one Father in heaven. The whole point is humility. Don't get these special titles and make yourself the elitist of the special that the Pharisees were trying to do. And right across this statement here is this: seeking titles and honor will result in eternal shame and humiliation. Humbly serving others as a servant of Christ is the only way to eternal exaltation. Service. Serving others, not exalting yourself. We've been across the same point several times already in the quarter. We talked about the Pharisees and they're kicking this off, giving a tenth of the little mint leaves and the seed and these various herbs and things like this. And they left off, and in doing this, they left off the important things: judgment, faith, and mercy. And he said, you do the little things, but you can't do them and exclude the big things, the things that don't need to be left undone. They criticized him for that. Then they talked about the whitewashed tombs and the platters and things that you want to make the outside pretty and beautiful, while the inside is full of rottenness and filth. What he's really talking about is the inside of the heart. You want to look good to the outside of the people, but inside the heart's not right. That's the whole point of it. So get the heart right and the outside will be clean. So, real quick, I'll leave you there. So, look at Matthew 24, if you will. Of course, there's parallels in Mark and Luke, but we're going to spend most of our time tonight, at least what I'll be talking about in Matthew 24. Jesus leaves the temple. Matthew 24, first two verses. Been in the temple all day. Like I said, Jesus started off with him cleansing the temple. Apparently been in the temple all day teaching, talking to the people, answering these oppositions, these questions. And the widow's mite came in during this time here. We saw her cast them two mites into the treasury. And now they leave the temple. At the end of the day, the disciples, the apostles probably referred to as the disciples. And the disciples called attention to the great beauty of the structure, the great temple, the huge stones that's in the temple, and how luxurious it looks there. A great and beautiful structure. They make comments about this there. And these stones, you can get different ones that reference different sizes of them, but took the one I went across. Talk about these stones being 70 feet long, 12 feet high, and 18 feet wide. Just humongous chunks of white limestone that's put here to build this temple out of. And Herod, when he redid it, we'll talk more about it in a minute, is the beautiful white stones and the gold overlay, and it is a enormously beautiful structure that's here. So they're commenting on that as they leave there. Of course, the temple is among the Jewish people was still supposed to be the very presence of God. Go back to the tabernacle, start back in the wilderness, and the holy place, the most holy place, and the mercy seat, the cherubims, and God being there in their presence. Of course, it moved on to the temple, the time there with it. So this is supposed to be where God was among his people in this great, beautiful temple. Oops. But at this time, it's the place where the Jewish leaders are not keeping the law that they're supposed to because of all their rejection and the changes going on. Because Caiaphas is a high priest now, and he's appointed by the Roman government to be in that position. He's not like the son of Aaron and the lineage is supposed to be. It's a political position type thing. So looking at the temple, this is the structure of it here somewhat. And it's like we got a problem that slides off the bottom down here. But once you see two or three things, this is a good view. This is a computer-generated picture, but I've shown it before. But it's a good picture of the Kidron Valley on the east side and, of course, across the Mount of Olives to down to Bethany. But this is the temple area itself. And right across the bottom of that slide where you can't see it, it's the actual dimensions there. But it's something like, if I remember right, 913 feet across here, 1,560 here, 1,590 here, and 1,035 across the end up here on the north side. So I got curious about how big it really was. How big is this temple complex area? Unfortunately, mathematically, if you do it, you have to have one of the angles on the corners, or you have to have a diagonal to actually mathematically calculate the size. So anyway, I just picked out that, hey, if this was a 90-degree angle here, I use those dimensions I just talked about. This thing calculates that'd be about 35 acres. I read later it's somewhere estimated between 26 and 35 acres. Well, I still need a little help trying to get that down in my head. A football field is just over an acre. So it's about 32 football fields size of space that this temple area took up. It's a very, very large complex. Think about the many Jews coming in for those feast areas. There's a lot of people. A lot of people could get in here. These outer courts and everything. But Jesus' whole point is, it's going to be destroyed. That's what he's about to tell them here. Verses 2 and 3. That they're calling his attention to the beauty of it. He said it's going to be destroyed. Not one stone left on another. These big, humongous stones of white limestone. Made in there. Or they'll be just flat. Gone. That brings up the conversation. Not one stone left on another. Total destruction of the temple area. Now you can imagine the shock the disciples would be in. What do you mean? We don't understand this. Because we've already read in John 2:20, Herod been 46 years and remodeling the temple. Keep in mind, go back to Solomon's temple that was destroyed and the little small temple they built when they came back from captivity. Now Herod has redone it and made it this big, humongous, beautiful structure. In fact, it seemed that the finishing up of the remodeling actually was not done until about the year 64 AD, the 6 years before it was destroyed. So it's just a big undertaking. This beautiful thing. Are you talking about destroying it? It's going to be gone? So they go across and they settle on the Mount of Olives. So picture them, well, leave the temple down through the valley. They go on the Mount of Olives looking back toward the temple and the city area. This is the picture of some of the destruction of that. It's been uncovered. There's ground level up here. You see the big holes knocked in the pavement here. Those stones fell on it. Some of the rubble from the stones that left and uncovered from the destruction. So, here's the big question for this chapter, Matthew 24. When Jesus starts getting into this, talking about the destruction, and we'll get into it in a minute. What destruction is he talking about? Destruction of the temple, the city of Jerusalem, or the end of the world? In Matthew 24 and 25, get into both of those. So the whole thing is, where do you divide it up? How do you make these chapters break up? So, we'll give you three different options that we'll talk about a little bit. Option one is that Matthew 24 and the related passages in Mark and Luke. Matthew 24 is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Matthew 25 is talking about the end of time, the second coming of Christ, and the end of the world. So one option says Matthew 24 is in the destruction of Jerusalem. Matthew 25 is other options some of the scholars have is that really all of it's intertwined. That one verse may be talking about in destruction of Jerusalem, and the next is talking about the second coming, and Jesus talks his questions, he just intermixes the answers, where it could be some applying to both at the same time. It's just a combination as you go through there. So that's one option. Another option. The third option, and there are various takeoffs on some of these I'm not getting into. Third option is that Matthew 24, down through verse 35, is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Matthew 24, starting verse 36 through 25, is talking about second coming and end of time. So you draw a line at verse 35. Down to there, it's talking about destruction of Jerusalem. 36 on is the destruction at the end of the world, and second coming. Several of the scholars you read talk about the difficulty in separating this. This is one little quote I found here. It says, in many respects, the most difficult problem in the evangelic record. Different scholars have a hard time figuring out where to break this up and how. So, let's think about that. Okay, I choose option three. You may have something different. That's fine. I'm going to go through and tell you why I choose this option. And later on, if you've got a different option, you can talk about something. I'm glad to give you some time to try to save some time for you to talk about that. So let's look at option three, that Matthew 24 down through verse 35 is destruction of Jerusalem. 36 forward, and the next chapter is the second coming. The key verse here is Matthew 24, verse 34. Where Jesus says that this generation, the people living now, this generation will not pass away. This generation will not die until all these things take place. And all these things here is going to be the things he's just been talking about from verse 4 down through verse 34. So verse 34 is the key transition. Everything down to here will not take place prior to this generation dying. Verse 35, he reaffirms that. He says, my word will not pass away. I am telling you, I'm speaking the truth. This is how it's going to be. I'm putting a reaffirmation on the statement he made in verse 34. If they leave the temple, go back to what we were just talking about here, at the end of verse, end of chapter 23, they've been in the temple, and they come out, and then verse 1, they talk about leaving the temple and going across the Mount of Olives. When Jesus starts telling about the destruction that's coming, we just talked about that. And in verse 2, we just talked about not one stone be left on the other. So that's the point he's making. The temple's going to be destroyed, along with it, Jerusalem will be destroyed. So then when they get across the Mount of Olives and sit down and look back at the city, the disciples ask him two questions. Tell us when these things will be. This destruction you're talking about. Tell us when it's going to happen. And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Two questions. Tell us about these things you just talked about. And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Now, two questions. But I don't think the disciples here are asking two separate questions, looking for two separate things. I don't think they're thinking about two separate events. Destruction of Jerusalem and end of time. I think they don't still have the concept of the coming kingdom. Christ's kingdom is we set up the church. Now, the concept of that, so they're envisioning if the temple's going to be destroyed, that's the end of the Jewish way of life, and it's the end of everything, and it's all going to happen at the same time. So then I don't think they're asking two separate questions, even though Jesus is going to answer them. That's two separate questions. So they envision all of it being, I think, one event. Now, look at verses 4 through 26. 26. I want you to look at the specific events that are going to occur. These events that are listed here are going to occur between now, which is, for an easy calculation, say AD 30, and the time this happens in AD 70. So you've got 40-year span in here. here's what some of the things Jesus says is going to happen. And listen how specific they are. And he says, like in verse 6, you hear wars and rumors of wars. Nation rise against nation, verse 7. Famines, pestilence, earthquakes. Deliver you up to tribulation. They'll kill you. You'll be hated by all the people for my name's sake. Verse 11, false prophets will come. Anything. Put on through verse 24, false Christ and false prophets will rise. So just a whole list here. Screen up here. That whole list of things that are going to happen before this destruction occurs. But they're all listed are very specific things that are going to happen. Very finite things. Famines, tribulations, hated by all nations, false prophets, lawlessness, false Christ. All these would be before the destruction. That's what's covered in 4 through verse 26. The things that are going to occur during these next 40 years. Verse 27 through 31 is the actual destruction of Jerusalem talked about. And it's talked about in a very figurative type language. But the same figurative language, if you go back and look in the Old Testament, it's the exact same language of the sun and moon's stars being darkened and the language is used there in these verses. The same language is used by the prophets in talking about the destruction that's going to come on various nations of the Old Testament, Egypt, Idumean, other places. So it's not, if the disciples know the language of the Old Testament, they're not going to be shocked at this language is used here. They're talking about destruction of this nation, because the same language has already been used in talking about destruction of the other nations. So 27 through 31 is actually, all these other things will happen in the next 40 years, and then the destruction of Jerusalem will come. Now, look then, draw the line here at verse 35. Look at verse 36 and after, which is the next section the way I'm looking at it. 36 and after says no one knows the day or hour. It talks about Noah and the preparation of the flood. Nobody knew the flood was coming until what? Until the flood came. Boom, it happened. He says, watch. You don't know when your Lord is coming. Like a thief in the night, a very uncertain time. An uncertain thing, you don't know when it's going to happen. The master came when the servant wasn't expecting. Down toward the end of the chapter. All these are uncertainties that are coming out there. They're going to happen. Watch. Be prepared. Don't know when. They're going to happen. Very, very different from the things that's in the first half of the chapter, which are very definite things that are going to occur. Another thing is, look at the word days and the word day. 19, 20, and 29. Verse 19. This is in the talking about things that will happen before the destruction of Jerusalem. For those who are pregnant, and those who are nursing babies in those days, this time span in here, days, plural. 22. Unless those days are shortened, no flesh will be saved. 29. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, or just it's days, it's time involved in this process here. But then when you flip down to the last half of the chapter, verses 36, for example. But of that day and hour, no one knows. Day, very specific. Of that day and hour. Verse 38. Until that day that Noah entered the ark, they know what's going to happen. Verse 50. The servant will come on a day when he's not expecting it. The same thing in chapter 25, verse 13. So the second coming here, when Christ comes the second time, is referred to as that day and hour, a very specific point in time. Boom, it's going to happen. So there's a very contrast between the first half of the chapter and the last half of the chapter in the word days across a period of time versus the second coming. When it happens, it happens. Well, this is all kind of confusing to you, but we'll try to run through it. So, when the destruction of Jerusalem comes, it's going to be the end of the Jewish state as they know it. This is the center of their life. Men all come to Jerusalem three times a year for the different feasts, make all the sacrifices. Again, God's presence among his people, the center of their worship, the feast, the day of sacrifices. It's going to be the end of one dispensation. and the beginning of another. The time of law of Moses ends in the destruction of Jerusalem. I know that I was the Christ on the cross, but it's the timing there is the same time frame. And then the beginning of a whole different thing that they're not used to, the dispensation of Christ. This all happens AD 70 when Rome comes and destroys the temple and destroys the city. About 40 year span here where we are. The final punishment on the Jewish nation for rejecting Jehovah, rejecting the Messiah, rejecting his son. Think about what's happened already in their past. And all the time they sent the prophets to them, carried anybody into captivity, and they come back, and they still can't follow. They still can't do what God tells them to. This is it. He's stopping it. Now, one thing you got to think about. You say, well, God's going to punish them for rejecting the Messiah and killing Christ. But then he has to die? Sure he did. He had to die for our sins. He's a sacrifice. But God didn't make the Jews choose to do this. They chose to reject him. There's examples of the Old Testament where the same thing happened. God uses the wickedness, the minds of men to accomplish his task. He doesn't make people make those decisions, but he uses those decisions to accomplish his task. So he uses the Jews' wickedness here of rejecting the Messiah to complete the sacrifice. So, let's go back now kind of to the verses 4 through 26. What's going to happen? Well, we just talked about that. Deceiver, others claim to be Christ, wars, famines, pestilence, earthquakes, false prophets, all these things are going to come. Verses 4 through 26. When it comes, flee. Get out. Don't go back to your house. It's time to run. It's time to go away. Hope it's not pregnant. Not in the wintertime, Sabbath day. It'll be a great desolation. It's going to be destruction like the world has never known. And then 27 through 31 is the actual destruction. They'll come in, lightning goes across the sky, like an eagle ripping a carcass apart. How severe it's going to be when Rome comes in. It's going to tear them up here. Romans is going to come in and tear the nation like animals running through a dead carcass and ripping it apart. Starts under Nero. He's the emperor when this thing starts. Nero dies. Vespasian is the, I think I'm saying it right, it's the general who's actually in Judea in charge of this destruction. When Nero dies, Vespasian is called back to Rome to be the new emperor. So his son Titus comes in and takes over as the general who's doing all the destruction on Jerusalem at this time. So those are the Roman generals that are involved in it here. I want a little footnote about the bottom line on the slide. That is Titus trying to save the temple. Read from Josephus. Of course, you know, Josephus is just one of the Jewish historians that considered to be very accurate. Actually says Titus had intended to save this beautiful big structure. He did not intend to destroy it when he came in. He told his army not to. But he was away from the temple area when there's another insurrection from among the Jews. And in that battle, that skirmish and fight there between the Roman soldiers and these Jews who were rising up against them again, the temple got set on fire, and that's where it actually burned. And Titus actually came back having tried to put it out. He didn't offer the temple to burn. But think about it. Titus couldn't save the temple. Why? What's Jesus already said is going to happen to it? It's going to be destroyed. So even though Titus's plan was that, he couldn't override God's will. And along the line with all this destruction that's going on, when Rome comes in and builds the siege walls, the mounds up around the wall, they can come and attack the city. It's also different bands of the Jews internally who start fighting against each other. And I read that from Josephus again that if you actually wanted to get out of the city, try to escape at that time, so like, they would kill you for trying to get out. Not like you get out in the Romans, the face of the Roman army. The Jews didn't let you, the ones that were fighting against it, when they let you get out. And food got to be just a shortage. People were killing and eating their own children. So they would come in, if they found food in your house, if you were eating, trying to put it in your mouth, they would have to turn you upside down and shake you, just get it out of you. It just got to be a real scene like we can really imagine. And there's siege going on in the city of Jerusalem. Roman legions surrounded the city, beginning to slowly squeeze life out of the Jewish stronghold. But in the year 70, the attackers had breached the Jerusalem outer walls and began a systematic ransacking of the city. The assault culminated in the burning and destruction of the temple that had served for the center of Judaism. And this little parable, about verse 32 to 33, about the fig tree. And we use it, illustrates that this time is near. It's at the door, it's coming. This generation will not pass away. So then, I think, after Jesus talks about, answers their question about when this thing going to happen, they just told us it's going to happen. They said, well, when's this going to happen? Then he shifts to kind of the second part of their question. That is, what's going to be the signs of your coming and the end of time? They ask it, I think, is one question, but he's actually separates it out. Because they're not going to be the same time. Destruction in Jerusalem is going to happen. And now I'm going to tell you about the second coming, about the end of time. And this starts in verse 36. So what are the signs of his coming? Well, no one knows what's going to happen, he says. No one knows except the Father. Like you read in Luke, it says the Son knows. But even scholars don't think, even the ones that I read from, don't think he even knew at this time when the second coming would be. He did not know until after his ascension back to heaven. But Matthew says that only the Father knows. Like the days of Noah, people aren't going to be prepared. They were prepared for the flood. Even though Noah preached to them, they were prepared. No one knows when the feast is going to come. This comes in the middle of the night. You better be prepared for it. You ready? The Son of Man's coming. In an hour you don't expect. He says, blessed is the one who's prepared. The preparation. Being ready. We talked about in the whole second half of this chapter. The Son of Man's coming back. Be ready. Like a thief of the night. Be prepared. It's coming. We don't know when. Woe to those who are not prepared. Weeping and gnashing of teeth. And then he goes on to chapter 25, which we'll get to Sunday morning, and gives three parables to illustrate this whole point of being prepared and being ready. Ready to give an answer when this second coming occurs. The parable of the virgin, of the 10 virgins and then the talents. And then the sheep and goat at the judgment day, destruction, right hand and left hand. Those are in 25. He talks more about this preparedness and being ready. So, there's a lot of points we're trying to get through. Now, you may have an entire different feeling about how this chapter breaks up. Like I said, a number of scholars say it's one of the hardest sections of the whole gospel area to try to figure out how to rightly divide it. It's all there. It's all truth. We don't doubt that. Guided by the Spirit. But how to separate it, scholars agree it's very difficult. So I've got 5 minutes left. If anybody's got comments about a different feeling about, I'm going to get in a debate with you. I'm glad to give you time to talk about it, though. I don't want to be one-sided here. Anybody's got comments or whatever. And I don't argue. I mean, I say there's a lot of opinions and breaks on it. Well, I think it references back to their question where they asked, when will the other coming? When will you be the sign of your coming and that part? Comprehension was there. Okay. There's another, I didn't get into it, but another, I guess I'll call it 3A or 3B or that 24 down through this, 24 down through verse 34 is describing the second, the destruction of Jerusalem And then the rest of that chapter is using the illustration of what's going to happen at the end of time to clarify what he believes is going to happen, destruction of Jerusalem. So I think the last half of the chapter is a clarification of what he said in the first half of the chapter. So, and there's lots of ways to look at this thing. I'm not saying what I told you is accurate. I've done a lot of reading on it. I had notes in my Bible from sermons I'd heard before on it. I looked at that. Talked to Stephen about it some. He reached off the shelf, gave me a book, which I crammed reading that book and some other stuff the last several days on this. This is just what I come with in my mind. Which I'll want to explain it the way I see it. You have a different. There's no doubt he's describing destruction of Jerusalem. I think there's also no doubt that 25 is talking about the end of time. The debate part going to come in the last half of chapter 24. Sunday we'll get into Matthew 25, which again I think is very confident. It's talking about the second coming and the end of time. Being prepared for that. Also get into the first part of chapter 26. So, all right, anybody else? I know it's a long, boring, dry topic. It's a big event to the Jews, the Jewish nation. What's happening here? And this thing with the apostles, Jesus is telling them, just trying to absorb what he's saying. But just, and I don't think they comprehended yet what's going on. All right, thank you very much.